readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I admit it, I feel like I might be swimming in unknown waters today. Magical realism, fantasy, call it what you will, this is definitely not my usual pick. But I am an intrepid traveler through the literary landscape. I've asked friends, I've done my research, and as it turns out, I have read works from some of these popular authors. I know many of you are devoted to this genre, so we're taking the plunge. But before we do, since this is such a huge category, I have a favor. Let me know which titles and authors I should preview the next time we discuss it. Drop me a quick email at elaine@bookreportradio.com. Well, here we go on our fantastic journey.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Ayla, the wildly popular heroine of Jean Ahl's Earth Children series, is back. Come on, you know we all read some of that series, starting with Clan of the Cave Bear in 1980, The Valley of the Horses in 82, The Mammoth Hunters in 1985, The Plains of Passage in 1990, The Shelters of Stone in 2002, and now The Land of the Painted Caves. Fanatic fans have been eagerly awaiting this book, and there's been an incredibly long gap between the last few in the series. But readers, I'm rolling my eyes on this one. The audio title is 29 CDs. Count them. That's a huge time commitment. And I had to ask myself on disc one, why does our Ayla now have this strange Slavic girl kind of accent?
Eesh.
And another question, can I listen to this for 28 more CDs? Answer, no. As I was looking over the other reviews, I have to tell you, most listeners agree with me on this one. So if you're a fan of this series, perhaps you need to opt for the print version. As this story opens, Ayla, her super hunky mate John Dalar, and their infant daughter John Ayla are living with the Zelindonyi in the Ninth Cave, a shelter of stone. Ayla has been chosen as an acolyte and has embarked on the arduous task of training to become a spiritual leader. The wisdom that Ayla gained from her struggles as an orphan child, alone in a hostile environment, has strengthened her as she moves closer to leadership. Her mentor takes her to see the sacred caves. They are filled with remarkable art, paintings of mammoth, lion, reindeer. The powerful mystical aura within these caves sometimes overwhelms Ayla, and the rituals of initiation bring her closer to death. But through these rituals, Ayla gains, wait for it, the gift of knowledge. So, you choose. I'm recommending the print version of this book, but this narration is done by Sandra Burr, and she's getting some rough reviews everywhere I look.
Suddenly, the cats hidden by the grass seemed to jump into clear focus. She could make out two young and three or four adult cave lions. As she started moving forward, she reached with one hand for her spear thrower, fastened to a carrying loop on her belt, and with the other for a spear from the holder hanging on her back.
"Where are you going?"
John Dalar asked. She stopped.
"There are lions up ahead, just beyond the split in the trail," she said under her breath.
John Dalar turned to look and noticed movement that he interpreted as lions now that he knew what to look for. He reached for his weapons as well.
You should stay here with John Ayla. I'll go.
Ayla glanced down at her sleeping baby, then looked up at him.
You're good with the spear thrower, Jandalar, but there are at least 2 cubs and 3 grown lions, probably more. If the lions think the cubs are in danger and decide to attack, you'll need help, someone to back you up, and you know I'm better than anyone except you.
His brow furrowed again as he paused to think, looking at her. Then he nodded.
All right, but stay behind me.
He detected movement out of the corner of his eye and glanced back.
What about the horses?
They know lions are near. Look at them,
Ayla said. Jandalar looked. All 3 horses, including the new young filly, were staring ahead, obviously aware of the huge felines. Jandalar frowned again.
Will they be all right? Especially little Gray.
They know to stay out of the way of those lions. But I don't see Wolf, Ayla said. I'd better whistle for him.
You don't have to, Jandalar said, pointing in a different direction. He must sense something, too. Look at him coming.
Ayla turned and saw a wolf racing toward her. The canine was a magnificent animal, larger than most, but an injury from a fight with other wolves that left him with a bent ear gave him a rakish look. She made the special signal that she used when they hunted together. He knew it meant to stay near and pay close attention to her. They ducked around people as they hurried toward the front, trying not to cause any undue commotion and to remain as inconspicuous as possible.
I'm glad you're here,
Joharan said softly when he saw his brother and Ayla with the wolf quietly appear with their spear throwers in hand.
Do you know how many there are?
Ayla asked.
More than I thought, the Fona said, trying to seem calm and not let her fear show. When I first saw them, I thought there were maybe 3 or 4, but they're moving around in the grass, and now I think there may be 10 or more. It's a big pride.
And they are feeling confident,
Joharan said.
How do you know that?
The Fona asked.
They're ignoring us.
Jandalar knew his mate was very familiar with the huge felines.
Ayla knows cave lions, he said. Perhaps we should ask her what she thinks.
Joharan nodded in her direction, asking the question silently.
Joharan is right. They know we're here, and they know how many they are and how many we are,
Ayla said, then added,
They may see us as something like a herd of horses or aurochs and think they may be able to single out a weak one. I think they are new to this region.
What makes you think so?
Joharan said. He was always surprised at Ayla's wealth of knowledge of 4-legged hunters, but for some reason it was also at times like this that he noticed her unusual accent more.
They don't know us. That's why they're so confident, Ayla continued. If they were a resident pride that lived around people and had been chased or hunted a few times, I don't think they would be so unconcerned.
Well, maybe we should give them something to be concerned about, Jandalar said.
Joharan's brow wrinkled in a way that was so much like his taller, though younger, brother's, it made Ayla want to smile, but it usually showed at a time when smiling would be inappropriate.
Perhaps it would be wiser just to avoid them, the dark-haired leader said.
If we're talking about fantasy, we must give a nod to Anne Rice, the vampire series. It all started in 1976. Can you believe it was that long ago? Interview with a Vampire. Who didn't read that one or see the movie? Anne's newest tale is Of Love and Evil, and it's getting strong reviews. I dreamed a dream of angels. I saw them and heard them in a great and endless galactic night. I saw the lights that were these angels, flying here and there in streaks of irresistible brilliance. I felt love around me in this vast and seamless realm of sound and light. Thus begins this lyrical, haunting novel, a metaphysical thriller of angels and assassins that summons up dark and dangerous worlds set in times past. Anne Rice takes us to the world of 15th century Rome, a city of domes and rooftop gardens, rising towers and crosses, of Michelangelo and Raphael, of the Holy Inquisition and Leo X, the second son of a Medici, holding forth from his papal throne. And into this time, into this century, Toby O'Dare, former government assassin, is summoned by the angel Malkia to solve a terrible crime of poisoning and to search out the truth of a haunting by an earthbound, restless spirit. O'Dare soon discovers himself in the midst of dark plots and counterplots, surrounded by a darker and more dangerous threat as the veil of ecclesiastical terror closes in around him. As he embarks on this journey of atonement, O'Dare is reconnected with his own past, with matters of light and dark, with the promise of salvation, and with a deeper and richer vision of love. The title is narrated by Paul Michaels.
They were people who had prayed before and would pray after and in the far future and would always pray, and all these voices had to do with what I might become, of what I might be. Oh, sad, small soul that I was! And how very grand was it, this burning world in which I found myself, a world that makes the very word itself meaningless, as all boundaries and all measures disappear. There came to me the blessed knowledge that every living soul was the subject of this celebration, of this infinite and ceaseless chorus, that every soul was loved as I was loved, known now as I was known. How could it not be? How could I, with all my failures, all my bitter losses, be the only one? Oh, no. The universe was filled with souls woven into this triumphant and glorious song. And all were known and loved as I was known and loved. All were known as even their prayers for me became part of their own glorious unfolding within this endless and golden weave. Don't send me away. Don't send me back. But if you must, let me do your will. Let me do it with all my heart, I prayed, and I heard my own words become as fluid as the music that surrounded me and sustained me. I heard my own particular and certain voice. I love you. I love you who made all things and gave us all things, and for you I will do anything. I will do what it is you want of me. Malkia. Take me. Take me for him. Let me do his will. Not a single word was lost in this great womb of love that surrounded me, this vast night that was as bright as day. For neither day nor night mattered here, and both were blended, and all was perfect, and the prayers rising and rising and overlapping, and the angels calling were all one firmament to which I completely surrendered. To which I completely belonged. Something changed. Still, I heard the plaintive voice of that angel pleading for me, reminding Malkia of all that I was to do. And I heard Malkia's gentle reproof and ultimate insistence. And I heard the prayers so thick and wondrous that it seemed I would never need a body again to live or love or think or feel. Yet something changed. The scene shifted. I saw the great rise of the earth beneath me, and I drifted downwards, feeling a slow but certain and aching chill. Let me stay, I wanted to plead. But I didn't deserve to stay. It was not my time to stay, and I had to feel this inevitable separation. Yet what opened now before me wasn't the earth of my expectations, but vast fields of wheat blowing golden under a sky more vivid in the brightening sun than I had ever beheld. Everywhere I looked, I saw the wildflowers, the lilies of the field, and I saw their delicacy and their resilience as the force of the breeze bent them to and fro. This was the wealth of the earth, the wealth of its blowing trees, the wealth of its gathering clouds. Dear God, never to be away from you, never to wrong you, never to fail you in faith or in heart, I whispered. For this, All this you have given me. All this you have given us. And there followed on my whisper an embrace so close, so total, that I wept with my whole soul. The fields grew vague and large, and a golden emptiness enveloped the world, and I felt love embracing me, holding me, as if I were being cradled by it. And the flowers shifted and turned into masses of colors I couldn't describe. The very presence of colors we did not know struck me deep and rendered me helpless. Dear God, that you love us so very much.
We all know and love the story of the Little Mermaid, but most of us are familiar with the sugar-coated Disney version and not the original from Hans Christian Andersen. Now, though, you can rediscover the beauty of the original story again in Carolyn Turgeon's Mermaid, A Twist on the Classic Tale. The story is magical and actually one of tragic love. Carolyn transports her readers to medieval Scandinavia. Carolyn graduated from Penn State, earned a master's in comparative literature from UCLA with a specialty in medieval Italian poetry. She spent several years in New York working as a writer and editor. Her first novel, Rain Village, was published in 2006. Her second, Godmother, the classic Cinderella story, was published in March 2009 and has been optioned for a film. Carolyn aspires to become an expert accordionist. Let's get Carolyn to tell us a little more about the book and why there's been an amazing surge of interest in mermaids. Welcome, Carolyn. It's great to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, what about the original story, Little Mermaid, prompted you to write a book about it?
Well, I actually really love the original story. I love Hans Christian Andersen. He's very weird and dark and strange. And I wanted to do something with that story, though it was a challenge because it's so strange and dark. I wasn't really sure how to enter it at all. But I figured out that I could do it through the figure of the princess who appears in the original story just very briefly at the beginning and at the end. And she's the one who ends up marrying the prince instead of the mermaid marrying him, but is really not a character at all. So I wanted to go in and explore her character and include the mermaid's perspective and then develop a relationship between the two women. I guess one thing that I like to do with these stories that so often put women in conflict with each other is to explore the relationships and the complications between those two women and make those relationships more central than their relationships with the prince or the male. So,
did you have trepidation about basing your book on the darker version as opposed to the one that we're all familiar with Ariel and the happy ending?
No, the main thing was just that it's such a depressing, strange, but very, very beautiful story that I had trepidation about how to go into it and do something interesting with it. And whereas my last book, Godmother, the Secret Cinderella Story, it was a hard book to write, but ultimately looking at the Cinderella story and being critical of it and looking at the darker side to it the story lends itself to that. Whereas The Little Mermaid is already as dark as you can get, really. So any version I was going to tell would be a little lighter, actually. So, but I now I'm having more trepidation, I guess, now that it's already done, in that I've seen a lot of readers' reactions where I'm not sure that how many people are familiar with the original version and what I've actually done with it, so.
Okay. Well, when you were writing the book, did you travel? It's set in Scandinavia, so did you actually travel there before or after or?
Yeah. No. As I was writing the book, I didn't do that, but I tried to look at pictures and things like that and get this kind of gloomy, icy Nordic setting down. But I actually ended up going there afterwards. This fall, I was in Berlin and decided to go up to Copenhagen and sort of just see where Hans Christian Andersen was from and learn more about him, since I had kind of, I felt like I'd been kind of in his world and in his head for so long. And so I went up to Copenhagen and I went around and with a little video camera with all kinds of Danish people looking at me like I was crazy, but I was videotaping all the little places where he lived. He lived in a bunch of different places in Copenhagen. And I took a train over to Odense. I don't know how to say that, but his hometown on Finn Island, that's about an hour and a half away, and visited his the home where he grew up and where he was born and places like that. And went to the big museum there where I learned how truly weird he was.
Tell us a little bit about that. I know he had a very sad love affair of his own, or...
Yeah, he, from what I can understand, he was just this kind of over-the-top person who was very dramatic and was always kind of swooning over everything and falling in love with everybody, men more privately, women more publicly, but was always having these kind of mad affairs in his mind with people who didn't seem to ever return those affections. And I guess from what we understand, he probably never had sex in his life, though he was committed to pleasuring himself, apparently, and to marking down every time this happened in his journal with some kind of special symbol. Anyway, so he's always heartbroken because no one returned his affections. Apparently, he was considered wildly unattractive. In the pictures I've seen, he looks all right, but I guess for that time he was, you know, he's very tall and lanky and he had these huge feet and this like big nose, and I guess people just thought he was really unappealing. And apparently his personality didn't help anything. And like he visited Charles Dickens for 5 weeks at one point when he was very famous. And then after he left, apparently Charles Dickens put a sign on his door saying something like, you know, Hans Christian Andersen once spent 5 weeks in this room and it seemed to this family ages.
Wow. So I take it that in his lifetime, his work was not accepted, or he was no success in his lifetime?
No, he became very successful. His work became very successful in his lifetime, but just personally, he didn't seem to have all that much luck. So, and actually when he wrote The Little Mermaid, one of his very best friends, Edward Cullen, was off getting married to a woman, and Hans was so upset by this, because this man didn't return Hans's affections, that he went off to his hometown and wrote The Little Mermaid. So this very sad story about this otherworldly, this wonderful otherworldly creature who longs to be accepted into the human world and just isn't, and is rejected, and the prince doesn't love her and he loves someone else. So I think it's a pretty beautiful way to deal with one's own heartbreak and rejection, but apparently that was a common state for him. Even though he became very famous and his stories became very loved in his lifetime, he just didn't seem to be able to attract the kind of love that he wanted.
Wow, Carolyn, you have turned the Disney world upside down with these revelations. Wow. Okay, I was wondering, since you also wrote a book about the Cinderella story, if you've read or had any inspiration from Gregory Maguire and his work in Wicked and Confessions of the Ugly Stepsister.
I actually haven't read those books, probably in part because I was afraid to be too influenced by them, though I understand that my stuff is really different. But I was definitely influenced by and inspired by the idea of going into a classic story and taking a totally new perspective from within it and retelling the story from that perspective. And especially just really well-known stories like The Wizard of Oz or like Cinderella, where you... to me, these seem like stories we grew up with that are just ingrained in you, ingrained in your blood and bones, you know, these classic stories. And so I think it feels kind of revelatory to go in and recast them from a perspective within it that you don't think about, like the witch in Wizard of Oz or the fairy godmother in the Cinderella story, or in his version, the stepsisters. But just you don't think about those perspectives, and you don't think of the story in terms of those perspectives. So I think there's something really, really cool about doing that and flipping a story over in that way.
And is your next project going to be based on a fairy tale as well?
Actually, I have my first children's book is coming out in late summer, and that is based on a fairy tale. It's this old story about a man who steals a swan maiden's feathered robe when she's bathing in the water in her human form, and ends up taking her home and marrying her and having children. And then one day she finds her robe and flies away. But my story is the story of that child who is now a 12-year-old girl who thinks her mother died when she was little. But then she starts growing feathers and it's totally embarrassing. And she starts wearing a hoodie to school and just feeling like a freak, like most 12-year-old girls do. But she really, really has reason. And then she discovers slowly that her mother was a swan maiden, that she's actually magical. So that's based on a number of fairy tales about the swan maiden. There are also similar tales about selkies and a selkie's seal skin being stolen and her going off to live with humans. So.
And what's the name of that book, that your children's book?
The Next Full Moon, and it's a middle grade book for 8 to 12-year-olds. Oh, but I think my next adult novel probably, I'm probably going to go into a different direction and write about the Weeki Wachee mermaids.
Oh, all right. Now, good. Tell us about this new trend of mermaiding. And I understand there's a mermaid camp, and I myself have been to Weeki Wachee, but for those our listeners not familiar, tell us all about this.
Okay. Well, Weeki Wachee is a live mermaid city in Florida that was built in 1947. And it's just this underwater theater built into the limestone of this natural spring. So, and it was once very glamorous. You'd go down to Florida, you'd be driving on one of the main roads and you'd get lured over and go into this little theater and watch women behind glass in the water in this natural spring acting like mermaids. And Elvis visited there in 1960, and then I think ABC bought it and made it into this even bigger theater, and girls from all over would come to try out to be a Weeki Wachee mermaid, and they were treated like royalty. But then with Disney coming in and the interstate, it's become more of a kind of weird roadside attraction. But visiting there, which I did for the first time a year ago, and then I've been back once since, and I've come to know a lot of these mermaids, especially the former mermaids. These are women who swam there and were mermaids there when they were very young and now are older and have come back to do the alumni shows. So I had lunch, for example, with this woman named Vicky, who's 71, and who is now performing in the alumni shows there. And these are the alumni mermaids who have since last year been running a mermaid camp for adult women. Hi. And Weeki has been, I guess they've had camps for little girls for years, but it was this one of the other former mermaids, Barbara Wins, had argued that adult women want to be mermaids just as much as little girls do. And so they finally started the Sirens of the Deep Mermaid Camp last year for adult women, and they have been successful. And I will be going in June, June 11th and 12th. And
now, does that mean you're going to be swimming? You're going to be learning to be a mermaid? Okay.
Yeah. You get makeup put on, you get a photo shoot with a tail on and everything, and then you get in the water and learn some basic moves. You can't do what real Weeki Wachee mermaids do because they're scuba certified and they go down deep and then they breathe out of these air hoses that are kind of hidden in the scenery so that they appear very mermaid-like, but I'll get to go in and do some little mermaid moves.
And you told me before that there's a mermaid convention in Vegas this summer.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah, I've been really surprised since I've, and this was after finishing the book, but before it came out, I started delving into this world, and a lot of things have weirdly come to me. Like, for example, when I was about to go to Weeki Wachee last spring, randomly 2 weeks before I went, I got an email from a woman named Julie Comenda, who's from Weeki Wachee. She's the artist in residence there. Just an email telling me she liked my books and stuff, and I said, well, that's weird, I'm going there in 2 weeks. And she became she actually met me and my family there and gave us a backstage tour and stuff. And she's the one who introduced me to all these other mermaids. So there have been a few weird things like that. But this convention will be held this August in Las Vegas at the Mirage Hotel. And it's the first one. And it's going to bring together all these tail makers. It's really like the last 10 years that people have started making mermaid tails that you can buy and then you can put on and then you can go swim in them and feel like a mermaid. And apparently, I've not done that, but apparently when you're swimming in one, it's, you know, it makes you swim faster and it gives you some extra kind of power, I guess. And so in the past 10 years, there have been more and more tail makers coming onto the scene. And so more and more people are able to go and actually buy mermaid tails, put them on, get in the water. And then, so there have been more and more professional mermaids who have created careers as a result. And there's this Hannah Fraser. There was a 2020 special on her last summer, but she's probably the most well-known and the oldest one because she started doing this like 9 years ago. And she's this amazing Australian woman who does deep sea diving and swims in her mermaid tail alongside killer whales and dolphins. And there's some amazing video of her doing this. So she's been an inspiration. So suddenly there are all these people around the world, you know, little pockets of people who are really into mermaiding and who have these kind of mermaid identities for themselves that seem to, you know, provide something magical and beautiful and powerful in their lives that maybe they don't have otherwise. And so now for the first time, there's this convention where a bunch of them will meet up. So all these tail makers will be in the same place and a bunch of mermaids and mermen will be there. And yeah, it should be pretty interesting.
I bet.
And one of the things that's going on is that the first night there's this huge pool party where I guess at least a few hundred mermaids and mermen will get into the water with their tails. And they want to set a world record for that. And while at a staged part of the pool, Hannah Fraser will be there doing some kind of performance and some other professional mermaids will also be performing. So,
all right. Well, Carolyn, this is a lot of new and really interesting information, and your book is really riveting. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye now. New meaning for the term dog day afternoon? Winston Churchill famously referred to his depression as a black dog, and in her debut novel, Rebecca Hunt, in one of the most original books I've read this year, brings this black dog to life. The year is 1964. The place is Britain. The listener meets Mr. Chartwell, or Black Pat, a mysterious figure who dogs Churchill as the elder statesman marches towards his retirement. And he plagues a young widow dealing with great sadness. Actor and veteran narrator Susan Dwerden brilliantly performs this novel. She seamlessly switches among the characters and is equally strong performing both the female and the male characters. Mr. Chartwell is a completely original look at characters struggling with depression, which Hunt gives almost a seductive quality. I recommend this title for your book club. I think people will come away from it with very strong opinions, and it'll make for a spirited discussion. As soon as I finished it, I offered it up to a friend who really likes darker titles. Well, this is not the book for the Pollyannas among your pals. Give it a read. It will give you lots to think about and talk about.
In a terraced house in Battersea, Esther Hammerhands came tearing down the stairs with one arm through a cardigan sleeve, the rest flapping at her legs, and turned off the hob. The kettle stopped its screaming, throwing out hysterical clouds of steam. Esther found the teapot and filled it with hot water, some spilling over the work surface. The tea leaves had been forgotten, something she discovered 5 minutes later, after a wild campaign with the washing up. Idiots! She cursed the tea leaves, beating them into the water with a spoon. Then she put on the entire cardigan. This seemed a good step, a positive move. A moment passed where she calmed herself. It was important to look calm. Mr. Chartwell would arrive at any minute. It was important that the first impression be a good one. She admired the yellow cabinet doors and drawers which she had scrubbed earlier. The walls painted a paler yellow and lit with a fluorescent bulb on the ceiling. The dark orange-tiled floor had been mopped, pots of spices and dried herbs arranged neatly on wiped white-gloss shelves. The blue formica-topped kitchen table was arranged with a vase of flowers, a stainless steel candlestick there for show, as if she used it every day. Sugar cubes were stacked into the only small bowl without chips, a tasteless bowl designed to resemble a cockerel. Esther had hidden the cockerel head lid in a drawer. Esther went to the mirror hung near the window and examined herself, seeing a wispy, long-haired person with a delicate underbite. She had always been slim, slimmer now, and a bit bare with it. The mirror returned a smile which expressed fatigue, a varnish of melancholy painted behind the features. The general package, Esther decided, would not benefit from further examination. The box room she wanted to rent didn't have many things, but it did have a garden view. Light mobbed every crevice from the first gloss of daybreak, and this would flaunt the room's extreme cleanliness. The carpet, meticulously hoovered, had come up well and showed its brilliant ochre colour, the colour of a toy lion. A decorative earthenware tile hung on the wall above the bed, a painted scene of a hillside village in Greece, the white cottages whirling with violently green and orange foliage, thick black lines everywhere, as if drawn with a thumb. Her friend Beth had loaned her a single bed, a very modest and old bed, which didn't look so humble when dressed with fresh sheets and blankets. The light bulb was decorated with a woven wicker shade, purchased last week, which Esther felt gave the room a sense of style. A new wardrobe completed the room's transformation into a bedroom. If necessary, she would throw in the occasional use of her car. But, disappointment, only one note of interest had answered her advert.
Kuntz has the power to scare the daylights out of you. And many readers feel that this title, What the Night Knows, is the author's return to top form. In the late summer of a long-ago year, a killer arrived in a small city. His name was Alton Turner Blackwood. In the space of a few months, he brutally murdered four families. His savage spree ended only when he himself was killed by the last survivor of the last family, a 14-year-old boy. Half a continent away and two decades later, someone is murdering families again, recreating Blackwood's crimes in horrible detail. Homicide detective John Calvino is certain that his own family, his wife and kids, will be targets in the fourth crime, just as his parents and sisters were victims on that distant night when he was 14 and he killed their slayer. As a detective, John is a man of reason and a man who deals in cold facts. But an extraordinary experience convinces him that sometimes death is not a one-way journey. Sometimes the dead return. Here is a ghost story like no other you have read. What the Night Knows brings you chilling suspense and a mesmerizing narration by Stephen Weber.
What year these events transpired is of no consequence. Where they occurred is not important. The time is always, and the place is everywhere. Suddenly at noon, 6 days after the murders, birds flew to trees and sheltered roosts. As if their wings had lanced the sky, the rain fell close behind their flight. The long afternoon was as dim and drowned as twilight in Atlantis. The state hospital stood on a hill, silhouetted against a gray and sodden sky. The September light appeared to strop a razor's edge along each skein of rain. A procession of 80-foot purple beeches separated the inbound and outbound lanes of the approach road. Their limbs overhung the car and collected the rain to redistribute it in thick drizzles that wrapped against the windshield. The thump of the wipers matched the slow, heavy rhythm of John Calvino's heart. He did not play the radio. The only sounds were the engine, the windshield wipers, the rain, the swish of tires turning on wet pavement, and a memory of the screams of dying women. Near the main entrance, he parked illegally under the portico. He propped the police placard on the dashboard. John was a homicide detective. But this car belonged to him, not to the department. The use of the placard while off-duty might be a minor violation of the rules, but his conscience was encrusted with worse transgressions than the abuse of police prerogatives. At the reception desk in the lobby sat a lean woman with close-cropped black hair. She smelled of the lunchtime cigarettes that had curbed her appetite. Her mouth was as severe as that of an iguana. After glancing at John's police ID and listening to his request, she used the intercom to call an escort for him. Pen pinched in her thin fingers, white knuckles as sharp as chiseled marble, she printed his name and badge number in the visitor's register. Hoping for gossip, she wanted to talk about Billy Lucas. Instead, John went to the nearest window. He stared at the rain without seeing it. A few minutes later, a massive orderly named Coleman Haynes escorted him to the third, top floor. Haynes so filled the elevator that he seemed like a bull in a narrow stall waiting for the door to the rodeo ring to be opened. His mahogany skin had a faint sheen, and by contrast, his white uniform was radiant. They talked about the unseasonable weather, the rain, the almost wintry cold 2 weeks before summer officially ended. They discussed neither murder nor insanity. John did most of the talking. The orderly was self-possessed to the point of being phlegmatic. The elevator opened to a vestibule. A pink-faced guard sat at a desk reading a magazine. "Are you armed?" he asked. "My service pistol." "You'll have to give it to me." John removed the weapon from his shoulder rig, surrendered it. On the desk stood a Crestron touchscreen panel. When the guard pressed an icon, the electronic lock released the door to his left. Coleman Haynes led the way into what appeared to be an ordinary hospital corridor. Gray vinyl tile underfoot, pale blue walls, white ceiling with fluorescent panels. "Will he eventually be moved to an open floor, or will he be kept under this security permanently?" John asked. "I'd keep him here forever, but it's up to the doctors." Haynes wore a utility belt, in the pouches of which were a small can of mace, a taser, plastic strap handcuffs, and a walkie-talkie. All the doors were closed. Each featured a lock-release keypad and a porthole. Seeing John's interest, Haynes said, "Double-paned. The inner pane is shatterproof. The outer is a two-way mirror, but you'll be seeing Billy in the consultation room." This proved to be a 20-foot square chamber divided by a 2-foot-high partition. From the top of this low wall to the ceiling were panels of thick armored glass and steel frames. In each panel, near the sill and just above the head height, two rectangular steel grills allowed sound to pass clearly from one side of the glass to the other. The nearer portion of the room was the smaller, 20 feet long, perhaps 8 feet wide. Two armchairs were angled toward the glass, a small table between them.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
The number one New York Times bestselling author Tammy Hoag returns with her second thriller in the Deeper Than Dead series, Secrets to the Grave. Here, the author explores the early days of forensic investigation, the characteristics of innocence, the nature of evil. Marissa Fordham has a past full of secrets, a present full of lies. Everyone knew of her, but no one knew her. When Marissa is found brutally murdered with her young daughter Haley resting her head on her mother's bloody breast, she sends the idyllic California town of Oak Knoll into a tailspin. Already on edge with an upcoming murder trial, residents are shocked by reports of the crime scene, which might not have been discovered for days had it not been for a chilling 911 call, a small child's voice saying, "My daddy hurt my mommy." Sheriff Detective Tony Mendez faces a puzzle with nothing but pieces that don't fit. To assist with his witness, Haley, he calls teacher-turned-child advocate Annie Leone. As Tony and Ann begin to peel back the layers of Marissa Fordham's life, they find a clue fragment here, another there. And just when it seems Marissa has taken her secrets to the grave, they uncover a fact that puts Ann and Haley directly in the sights of a killer. Marissa Fordham never existed. Let's listen as Kirsten Potter narrates.
The house stood by itself back off the road in a field of dried golden grass, half hidden by spreading oaks. An amalgam of styles, part Spanish, part ranch, the once white stucco building was weathered in a way that made it seem a part of the natural surroundings, as if it had grown up out of the earth and belonged there as much as any of the 100-year-old trees. The scene was a plein air painting, soft and impressionistic. The golden grass, the dark trees, bruised purple mountains in the background, and the whisper blue sky strewn with long, thin, pink-tinted clouds, the small white house with its old tile roof. On the other side of the mountains, the sun had begun its descent toward the ocean. Here, the day seemed to have paused to admire its own perfection. Stillness held the landscape enraptured. Nothing gave away a hint of what lay within the house. The driveway was a path of dirt and crushed rock, with grass and weeds sprouted up the middle like the mane of a wild pony. Falling down fences the color of driftwood created the lane between two overgrown pastures that had once been home to cattle and horses. A vintage woody station wagon, well past its glory days, was parked at a casual angle near an open shed full of rusted farm equipment. An old radio flyer red wagon had been abandoned near the front porch, with an orange tabby cat sitting in it, waiting for a ride. On the porch, two kittens played peekaboo among overgrown pots of parched geraniums and kitchen herbs. One propped herself up on the screen door and peered into the house, then squeaked and leapt and dashed away, tail straight up in the air. Inside the house, nothing moved but flies. A horrible still life had been staged on the saltillo tile kitchen floor. A woman lay dead, her hair spreading out around her head like a dark cloud. Her skin was the color of milk. Her lips had been painted as red as a rose, as red as her blood must have been as it drained from the wounds carved into her flesh. She lay discarded like a life-size broken doll, made up, torn up, and cast aside, her brown eyes cloudy and lifeless. Beside her lay a smaller doll, her child, head resting on her shoulder, face streaked with the last of her mother's life's blood. The flies buzzed. The wall clock ticked above the sink. The telephone receiver dangled near the floor, stenciled with small bloody fingerprints. The last words spoken into it were a whisper, still hanging in the air. "My daddy hurt my mommy."
The Girl with Glass Feet is an inventive and richly visual novel by Ali Shaw. Readers who love the works of Alice Hoffman might enjoy this take about young lovers on a quest to find a cure for a magical ailment. Strange things are happening on the remote and snowbound archipelago of St. Helda's Land. Unusual winged creatures flit about, albino animals hide themselves in the snow-glazed woods. Ida McLaird is an outsider in these parts. She had only visited one time before, and now she has returned to search for a cure she believes she will find there. Ida, you see, is slowly turning into glass. Midas Crook is a young loner who has lived on the islands his entire life. When he meets Ida, something about her sad, defiant spirit pierces his emotional defenses. As Midas helps Ida come to terms with her affliction, she gradually unpicks the knots of his heart. Yet time is slipping away. Will they find a way to stave off the spread of the glass? This is an imaginative and magical first novel. The Girl with Glass Feet is read by Heather O'Neill.
His father had once told him a legend. Lone travelers on overgrown paths would glimpse a humanoid glow that ghosted between trees or swam in a still lake. And something, some impulse from the guts, would make the traveler lurch off the path in pursuit into the mazy trees or deep water. When they pinned it down, it would take shape. Sometimes it would form a flower of phosphorescent petals. Sometimes it drew a bird of sparks whose tail feathers fizzed embers. Sometimes it became like a person, and they'd think they saw, under a nimbus like a veil, the features of a loved one long lost. Always the light grew steadily brighter until, in a flash, they'd be blinded. Midas's father hadn't needed to elaborate on what happened to them after that, lost and alone in the cold of the woods. It was nonsense, of course, like everything his father had said. But light was magic, making the dull earth vivid. A shaft of it hung against a tree trunk, bleaching the cracked bark yellow. Enticed, Midas crept towards it and captured it on camera before it sank back into the loam. A quick glance at his display screen promised a fine picture, but he was greedy for more. Another shaft lit briars and holly ahead. It made the berries sharply red, the leaves poisonously green. He shot it and harried another that drifted ahead through the undergrowth. It gathered pace, while Midas tripped on roots and snagged his ankles on strands of thorns. He chased it all the way to the fringe of the wood and followed it into the open, where the scrubland sloped down and away from him towards a river. Crows wheeled in a sky of oily rags. Hidden water gurgled nearby, welling into a dark pool at the bottom of the slope. Above the pool, the ray of light dangled like a golden ribbon. He charged down the slope to catch it, feet skidding on mushy soil and sharp air driving into his lungs as he stumbled the last distance down to the banks.
Diana Gabaldon's immensely popular Outlander saga now soars to new heights with Echo in the Bone, the seventh novel. This takes listeners on a journey to 1777 America. Word of caution, readers, right up front. All the reviews insist that if you haven't read the prior titles in this series, don't just jump into this one. Start at the beginning. Work your way through them. One of the pleasures of the Outlander series is developing a depth of knowledge of the individual characters and their complex relationships to each other. Okay, back to this title. Jamie Fraser knows from his time-traveling wife, Claire, that no matter how unlikely it seems, America will win the Revolutionary War. But that truth offers little solace, since Jamie realizes he might find himself pointing a weapon directly at his own son, a young officer in the British Army. Jamie isn't the only one with a tormented soul, for Claire may know who wins the conflict, but she certainly doesn't know whether or not her beloved Jamie survives. This title features a colorful cast that includes many legendary figures, including hero-turned-traitor Benedict Arnold and body statesman Benjamin Franklin. Davina Porter, one of my favorite narrators, does a wonderful job with the narration and the different voices. Echo has been long awaited and lives up to expectations.
It was so lovely to meet you, though. I wish we might talk longer. She said this with the greatest sincerity and touched his arm lightly, giving him a pleasant sensation in the pit of the stomach. The idlers were now placing wagers on the reappearance of the drowned pirate, though by the looks of things, none of them had two groats to rub together.
2-1, he's still there when the tide goes out.
5-1, the body's still there, but the head's gone. I don't care what you say about the grisly bits, Lem. That there head was just a-hanging by a thread when this last tide come in. Next one'll take it, sure.
Hoping to drown this conversation out, William embarked on an elaborate farewell, going so far as to kiss Mrs. Mackenzie's hand with his best court manner, and, seized by inspiration, kissed the baby girl's hand too, making them all laugh. Mr. Mackenzie gave him rather an odd look, but didn't seem offended, and shook his hand in a most republican manner, playing out the joke by setting down his son and making the little boy shake hands as well.
"Have you killed anybody?"
the boy inquired with interest, looking at William's dress sword.
"No, not yet," William replied, smiling.
"My grandsire's killed 2 dozen men."
"Jimmy!"
Both parents spoke at once, and the little boy's shoulders went up around his ears.
"Well, he has."
"I'm sure he is a bold and bloody man, your grandsire," William assured the little boy gravely. "The king always has need of such men."
"My grandad says the king can kiss his arse,"
the boy replied matter-of-factly.
"Jimmy!"
Mr. Mackenzie clapped a hand over his outspoken offspring's mouth.
"You know your grandad didn't say that," Mrs. Mackenzie said. The little boy nodded agreeably, and his father removed the muffling hand.
"No, Granny did, though."
"Well, that's somewhat more likely," Mr. Mackenzie murmured, obviously trying not to laugh. "But we still don't say things like that to soldiers. They work for the king."
"Oh,"
said Jemmy, clearly losing interest.
"Is the tide going out now?"
he asked hopefully, craning his neck toward the harbour once more.
"No," Mr. Mackenzie said firmly. "Not for hours. You'll be in bed."
Mrs. Mackenzie smiled at William in apology, her cheeks charmingly flushed with embarrassment, and the family took its leave with some haste, leaving William struggling between laughter and dismay.
"Oi! Ransom!"
He turned at his name to find Harry Dobson and Colin Osborne, 2 second lieutenants from his regiment, evidently escaped from duty and eager to sample the flesh pots of Wilmington, such as they were.
"Who's that?" Dobson looked after the departing group, interested.
Mr. and Mrs. Mackenzie, friends of my father's."
"Oh, married, is she?"
Dobson sucked in his cheeks, still watching the woman.
"Well, make it a bit harder, I suppose, but what's life without a challenge?"
"Challenge?" William gave his diminutive friend a jaundiced look.
"Her husband's roughly 3 times your size, if you hadn't noticed."
Osborne laughed, going red in the face.
"She's 2x his size. She'd crush you, Dobby."
"And what makes you think I mean to be on the bottom?" Dobson inquired with dignity.
Osborne hooted.
"What's this obsession of yours with giantesses?" William demanded.
He glanced at the little family, now nearly out of sight at the end of the street.
"That woman's nearly as tall as I am." "Oh, rub it in, why don't you?"
Osborne, who was taller than Dobson's 5 feet but still a head shorter than William, aimed a mock kick at his knee. William dodged it and cuffed Osborne, who ducked and shoved him into Dobson.
"Gentlemen!"
The menacing cockney tones of Sergeant Cutter brought them up sharp. They might outrank the sergeant, but not one of them would have the nerve to point this out.
Well, we've been under the sea, time traveling, and beyond the grave. Hope you've enjoyed the trip. I know I have. As I said before, since I'm kind of new to this genre, please send me your favorites for books we can cover the next time around. Elaine at Book Report Radio. It doesn't have to be just about fantasy and magic. I'd love to hear from you about titles you loved and would like to share with others. So check out the website, www.bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to Erin James for our theme song. I think her work is kind of magical. See you next week on The Book Report.